Appreciate the instrumentalists. They do a great job, and so I want to preface that by what I'm going to say, but when the instruments dropped out, just hearing all the voices was encouraging. Now, don't worry, I'm not planning to get rid of the pianos or anything like that, but just when you hear all the voices singing together, I don't know about you, when I hear other voices, it makes me want to sing out, and so I found that encouraging to hear the other voices singing as the instruments dropped out there at the end. Job chapter 3, turn in your Bibles to Job chapter 3 this morning as we continue in our series in the book of Job. Have you ever wanted to die? All right, I'm serious question. Have you ever found yourself in a place in life where you wanted to die? I don't mean melodramatically, all right? When I was, I wouldn't say that I wanted to die at this point, but there was a point in, I was 13 years old when I came down with chicken pox. That's not the ideal time to get them. If you get them, and once you get into adolescence, they're worse. And so I without being disgusting, my mom counted there were 1,000 pox on my back, 1,000 different pox from the chicken pox, and then they were all over. I had them in my mouth and things like that, not just on my skin, but they were, it was quite bad. My sister, who's younger than me, about 4 years younger than me, had a light case of them. She maybe had 3 chicken pox on her arm, you know, or something like that. She had a fairly light case of them, and we were obviously contagious, so we were home from school, and we were sitting there, and we used our, my parents used their library card a lot to go to the library and get as many VHS cassettes as they could get. I think I watched every Disney movie that existed at the time. It was mostly, you know, Old Yeller and Davy Crockett and those kind of movies that I remember watching, and sitting there just, you know, knowing you're not supposed to scratch these things. It's not good. They'll scar and things if you scratch them. And my sister's sitting on the couch. I'm sitting in the recliner, and we're watching whatever, Old Yeller or something. And she starts going, "Mom, it itches." Now, she's got like 3 on her whole person. And I'm covered in them. And I'm like, "Be quiet." Now, she's a mother now and has her own children and works very hard. And I know she would not be that dramatic about it as she was then. She's got much higher tolerance for things, as most of you mothers can understand, than she did then. But I remember at the time being like, "Just stop." But, you know, she was acting like she was dying from the chicken pox, and she wasn't. I don't mean being melodramatic. Maybe you've been a place in your life where the emotional pain you were in, you said, "Lord, I can't handle this. Just take me to heaven." Or the physical pain you were in was so bad that you said, "Lord, I can't handle this. Just take me to heaven. I can't live any longer." All right? I think many in this room have probably found themselves in that place. I don't mean you were suicidal. You weren't planning to kill yourself. But you were at a place where you're like, "Lord, I'm ready to go. Let's be done. This life is hard." This is the place that we find Job in Job chapter 3. This is the place we find Job in Job chapter 3. Let's review a little. Remember, there are 3 principles here that the book of Job is trying to work out. And they are that Job is righteous. Now, we've said chapters 1 and 2 establish that. There is no question of Job's righteousness in the first 2 chapters of this book. The second principle is that God is righteous. In other words, he's a righteous God. He does what's right. He's just. So Job is righteous. God is just. The third principle is what we call the retributive principle. There's retribution. You do what's wrong, you'll get bad. You do what's good, you'll get good. Okay, the retributive principle. So that if you, you know, if you live a violent life, you might die a violent death. And so, here's the issue. Job is righteous, we know that, but yet he's been good and he's not getting good, he's getting bad. So is the retributive principle wrong, or is God not just? See, there's one point of these 3 that's already anchored in this book, that is Job's righteousness so far. But what's the problem? The retributive principle or God's justice? Is God unjust and therefore punishing Job falsely? Or is there something about the retributive principle that we're wrong about? In other words, is there not always retribution? Job chapter 3, then, we find Job has come to the place where he's lost everything. He's lost all of his wealth. He's lost his children. Okay, he's gone through a terrible time. Lost his family. His wife has come to him and said, "Curse God and die." In other words, she's taken the side that the retributive principle is clearly true and you're clearly righteous, so God's unjust. You might as well curse him and die. He's not worth serving. And not only that, but Job has lost his health, so that he's sitting there with this skin disease. He's lost everything. He's in pain. His health is gone. The only thing he still has is that he's alive. And what we find is his friends have come and they come to comfort him, but they just sit and look and mourn with him. And we come to verse 1 of chapter 3. Then we find that after they sit for a while, after this opened Job his mouth and cursed his day, his day is his day of his birth. And Job spake and said, now the word for curse here is not the word that's used previously in the book, all right? Literally it says, his wife says, bless God and die. Satan says, if you take away what Job has, if you take away his health, he will bless you to your face. But those are euphemisms, because saying curse God is obviously a very harsh thing to say, so the book doesn't use it this way. This is literally the word for curse. And so what we find here is Job cursed his day, and he says, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said there is a man-child conceived. Now this is beginning the poetic sections of the book. All right, it begins to be Hebrew poetry, and Hebrew poetry uses parallelism and imagery. One of the things we have to understand about Hebrew poetry is we need to be careful that we not get overly literal with it, because it is poetic. We understand that poetry uses a lot of symbol. In other words, if you get overly literal with poetry, you can make the Bible say some silly things. Do you believe that God is a rock? See, a rock? If I went out and picked up a stone, could we say, is this God? But yet the Bible says our God is a rock. So he's a rock, right? No, see, they'd be being silly literal. He's a rock in the sense that he's a big, you know, outcrop of rock that's secure and strong and unmovable. It's not because he's made out of stone, okay? And so as we go through this Hebrew poetry, we need to understand that he's speaking very poetically here. And so what he's saying is, I wish that the day I was born didn't exist. Verse 4, let the day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for the night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come unto the number of months. In other words, let's take it off the calendar. All right? Find my birthday, take it off the calendar. In fact, in the ancient world, they viewed it as there were certain days that were blessed by God. And what he's saying is, God, remove your blessing from the day of my birth. I mean, normally we view our birthday as a good day, right? Generally. Our birthdays come around, we get excited about them. It's the time when we celebrate another year of life. And this is the day we were born, and we celebrate those we love, their birthdays. And here's Job saying, I wish my birthday wasn't on the calendar. I wish the night that I was born didn't exist. Verse 7, lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. All right? Those in here who have children, you know there was joy and rejoicing when your children were born. All right? Even though sometimes it was in the middle of the night. Babies just like to come in the middle of the night for some reason. Right? People are born at 2 and 3 in the morning. 4. Now, obviously, they come all different times of the day, but you know, the baby's not concerned with what time it is, right? And honestly, once the baby's born, neither are the parents. You might be tired, but, you know, 4 a.m., that child's born, there's rejoicing. You're not saying, oh, I'm not staying up for this. Right? There might be some things we say that about. But not for the birth of our children. Obviously, mom has no choice, but, you know, dad, what would you do, wives, if your husband said, I'm not staying up, you know, I'll be here in the morning? You'd say, no, this is not going to go well for you. Right? So there's usually rejoicing, but here's what he's saying. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. In other words, let nobody rejoice that the day of my birth was the day of my birth. Let them curse it that curse the day who are ready to raise up their mourning. All right, now he's in a very ancient Near Eastern context here, and there were people in the ancient Near East who were sorcerers, if you would, soothsayers and magicians and others, and they would put curses on things. Now, we know they had no real power to do that, but they believed they could manipulate magic somehow. And so what he's saying is, those who curse days, let them curse this day. You know, I wish that those who curse days would curse my day. There is some discussion in the commentaries whether it's talking about the soothsayers or whether it's talking about the mythological creatures in the various myths of their day that brought curses. But regardless, what he's saying is he's speaking very much in a poetic sense, and he's saying, you know, that day was so bad. It's so bad. I wish it didn't exist, and I wish there would be a curse on it. Verse 9, let the stars of twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day. Because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. Here's what Job's saying. At this point, he's not saying, I wish I was dead. He's just saying, I wish I was never born. I wish the day of my birth hadn't existed. It'd be better if I'd never been born. And we do find that expression in Scripture sometimes, don't we? Jesus says about some people that it'd be better if they were never born. That if a person who would teach a young child to sin, who would lead them to stumble and sin, that Jesus says it'd be better that a millstone were hung around his neck and he were cast in the depths of the sea. He says of Judas, it would be better that he'd never been born. And so what we find here is Job is in this place where he's just in such grief that he's saying, you know, why was I ever born? I wish I never existed. Now he starts to talk about his death in verse 11. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? In other words, why wasn't I stillborn? Why didn't I die right after birth? Why did the knees prevent me? Remember, the King James word prevent means to receive, all right? Doesn't mean to hinder. Or why the breast that I should suck? For now should I have lain still and been quiet, I should have slept, then I had been at rest. He's saying it would have been better for me to die the day I was born than to go through all the misery I've gone through now, than to go through all the trials that I'm going through now. That I've been at rest, look what he says here, with kings and counselors of the earth, which built desolate places for themselves. So here's what he's talking about. He starts in poetic language to start to describe things. You know, think of these ancient kings who died long ago. I mean, there are some men who at one point were the most powerful men in the world, and you don't even know their names. How many Assyrian kings can you give me? How many names? Okay, you might recognize a few of them from the Bible, Sennacherib or something like that. But yet there were Ashurbanipal and some of these people who were literally the most powerful man in the world when he was alive, and yet you don't think about him very much. You don't know what he built. In fact, most of what he built lies in ruins today. And here's what Job is saying. They dwelt in desolate places. In other words, they built desolate places for themselves. They weren't desolate when they lived there. They became desolate. Now they're dead. They're at peace is the way he's describing it. Compared to you have to understand how he's looking at this. Compared to the struggles of this life, the afterlife was much more difficult for the ancient Israelites. By that I mean they didn't have all the clear revelation we have in the New Testament. I don't think they didn't have a hope. I do believe they had a hope. Okay, but I don't think they understood details as well as we do. And so especially for somebody in Job's era, about the time of Joseph, for him it's like, I know that if I'm dead, then I'm not hurting anymore. I'm not really sure what that netherworld is like, what it's exactly like. All right, the Old Testament uses this word Sheol for that place that the dead went to. Sometimes they use it of the literal pit the body was put in, but sometimes it's used of that place that the spirit of the departed went. And it generally doesn't make a big distinction between the righteous and the unrighteous going there. Now we get to the New Testament, we have a description of a place where Abraham is there and those who are in paradise with Abraham, and then we have a place where there are those who are in torments and there's a great gulf between them. And so in the New Testament, you start to have more revelation. Some are getting good, some are getting bad. But in the Old Testament, there's not that much detail. And so their hope is that someday, you know, God's going to raise them back up. But the idea that, you know, heaven and those kinds of things. That's not that clear to them. What he does know is that it means a rest from the hardness of this life, the difficulty of this life. Now, for us as Christians, we have such greater hope because we have more details. It's not that we believe differently. It's that we just have more details. And think about that. That means there are times in a Christian's life when you get to the point in life where you say, I'm, you know, and I've talked to believers like this. I'm ready to go. They've lived 90 years. They're tired. Their body's failing. They say, I'm not afraid to go to heaven. I'm ready to go. Okay, now death is always an enemy and a difficulty. But here, Job is looking at it as a relief from everything he's gone through. Think of it. It's not just physical pain. There's emotional pain here. He's lost his children. He's lost his wealth. He's lost the respect of everyone around him. And now he's sitting here with a skin disease, scraping his skin with broken pieces of pottery. And he says, I wish I was with those dead kings whose cities now lie in ruins. Or with the princes that had gold who filled their houses with silver. Or as an hidden, untimely birth I had not been, as infants which never saw light. There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. In other words, the wicked man, he can't do anything to anybody because that person's gone. The weary are at rest. It's done. Life is over. There the prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor. In other words, slaves, they don't get driven by the whip anymore once they're dead. The small and the greater there, and the servant is free from his master. So notice he said two things now. I wish that the day of my birth had been cursed. I wish it wasn't on the calendar. Second, I wish I would had died in childbirth rather than lived this miserable life that I've lived. That's what Job has said so far. Because if I were dead, then at least I'd be at rest. I wouldn't have this struggle anymore. Verse 20. Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul, which long for death, but it cometh not, and dig for it more than for hid treasures. In other words, at this point, if you offered Job a treasure chest or you offered him death, he'd choose death. That's where he is. Which rejoice exceedingly and are glad, when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid and whom God hath hedged in? This is an interesting phrase. All right, whom God hath hedged in. This is negative here. He's using God's hedge as a negative thing. In other words, God has hedged him in a place where he's stuck. In other words, he's stuck with his misery. A hedge keeps people out. All right? We don't use hedges as much here. We tend to use walls and fences. But there are parts of the world where they use hedges. Plants that are very dense, sometimes thorn-filled. In fact, the plant that the crown of thorns was made out of is often used as hedging in the ancient world. And so you've got, you know, 4-inch thorns. You're not going to go running through that. And you plant these things tight together and they interweave as they grow and they get taller than a man. You're not going to squeeze through that. You get torn up going through it. Too costly. You're not going to climb over it. You get torn up. So here's what Job has said. God has built a hedge around me to trap me here. But the interesting thing is, let's go back to chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 8. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? And Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? Does he fear you for no reason? He only does good because, you know, he's got bad motives. Because you do good for him. Hast not thou made an hedge about him? And about his house and about all that he hath on every side? All right, God doesn't dispute this. God had put a hedge around Job that had protected him from calamity. From his things being spoiled and his children dying and his health being ruined. God had done this. But here Job says, God's put a hedge around me and trapped me in this misery. Now notice, he's not cursing God yet. He just doesn't know what the answer is. In other words, he's puzzled because he says, I know that I'm righteous. Job's not questioning that. And he believes God is just, but he thinks there must be some confusion or something here. Is there something God doesn't know? And there's something Job's missing? How could God, in other words, he's at the point of questioning, not denying God. He's at the point of questioning, not denying God. And so here he's looking at the hedge that's around him. He's stuck. That God hath hedged in, for my sighing cometh before I eat, and my roarings are poured out like the waters. Here he is crying, wailing, sighing, for the thing which I greatly feared is to come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. What was he afraid of? Again, you were back in chapter 1. What do we see here? Verse 4 of chapter 1, and his sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them. This was a normal, probably a normal festival that people would observe. And rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. So Job would offer sacrifices on behalf of his family to make sure that they hadn't offended God somehow. So what was he afraid of? He was afraid that his children would do something rash, that they would do something that offended God, and that God's judgment would come upon them. All right? He was worried. I don't think there's any question about that. I think we all worry from time to time, don't we? Sure we do. We worry about our children, we worry about our finances, we worry about our health, we worry about things. We take anxious thoughts for them. All right, we lose sleep at night because of things that are going on in life. That I don't know if you've ever been in that place where there's things concerning you and you would love to sleep, but you simply can't. Your body is on alert. It's like you can't go to sleep, you got to fix things, and there's nothing you can fix. Right? We're not just talking about, you know, a physical thing. It's just you're tied up and you just can't go to sleep. Or you do go to sleep because you're exhausted, and then you, 3 hours later, are tied in knots again. As soon as your body has the energy to be anxious again, you're anxious. All right? Worry happens to all of us. The Bible gives us warnings about it. Jesus says, don't take any anxious thought for what you shall wear or what you shall eat or what you shall drink. Now, I'm not quoting that glibly. I want us to understand that we all have these anxieties and fears and cares, and there are things. And the fact of the matter is that often that worry is almost worse sometimes than when the actual event comes. I don't think that's true in Job's case. But in many of our lives, we're worried about something, and sometimes the thing that we're worried about happens, and it wasn't as bad as our worry about it was. Sometimes. But many times, it is a bad thing, and difficulties come into our life, and hardships and grief and loss and pain and physical pain and suffering comes into our life, and we don't want it, and we've dreaded it. He says, the thing I greatly feared has come upon me. He's lost his children, he's lost his wealth, and that which I was afraid of has come unto me. He's lost his health. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. See what he's saying? He wasn't resting. It's not as if he was just going about his business and not concerned about things. He was concerned about his business. He was concerned about his children. He was concerned about these things. He had worry about those. He had fear that something bad might happen, and he was trying to do everything he could to head it off, and yet it still happened. It still happened to him. And it's still going to happen to us. All right? You will not get through this life and escape bad things. Won't happen. If the Lord tarries, every person in this room will die. You can't cheat death. It will happen. Every person in this room has, if you've lived long enough, has seen grief. You've seen the grief of a wayward child. You've seen the grief of losing someone prematurely. You've seen the grief of a financial reversal. your pension being stolen, embezzled by somebody, your house being foreclosed on, your going into a bankruptcy, a marriage coming apart, all right? I don't make light of these things, but what we need to understand is that they come into our lives. And that's why I say, for the purpose of the book of Job, we have to understand we're all Job. We're not all as righteous as Job. I recognize that. But we're all going to get to a place in our life where the things we feared come. The things that we said, I hope that never happens to me, some of it is going to happen to us. See, and what happens is we think, I'm righteous. And there's a retributive principle that says, if you do good, you get good. If you do bad, you get bad. And what happens is we can't come into life and we go, I've been good. I've kept all the rules. I've done everything right. And yet this bad thing happened to me. How does this work? How is God fair? How is he just? How can any of this happen? And we find ourselves in the same place as Job. Maybe not identical circumstances. We may not be as righteous as Job, and we may not suffer as deeply as Job, but his deep righteousness and his deep suffering only focus and magnify this truth for us, that we're going to come to places in life where we say, God, I don't understand. This is hard. This is difficult. And I'm not going to leave you hanging here at this point in the book, but I want us to be in deep enough that we can feel what Job's feeling a little. Because we're all Job, all right? We're all going to be here. We're all going to have difficulties. We're all going to have trials. And we can't look at life and say, God, I did everything right. Why would you give me this? We're going to ask that question a lot in life, but we're all going to be like Job. And the answer we're going to get is not going to be, here's what you did wrong and why you got that. So that's what the friends expect. That's what others expect in the book. The answer we're going to get is very different. When we get to the God speech, the answer is more like, trust me. Now, I want us to consider something here. I want us to consider that even a righteous man like Job gets to a place where he gets to this spot, where he wishes that his birthday was nothing, that he'd never been born, or that he died prematurely, or that he was sleeping in death, the way he looks at it, so that he's not suffering anymore. That he's not being pursued by the cares and the difficulties of this life. Now, he hasn't cursed God. Notice, he hasn't said God is unrighteous yet. He just has said, look, I'm righteous, but I'm suffering, and I don't know why God brought this into my life. Now, there are some things that you do them, and you kind of go, okay, I can understand there was a direct cause-effect that you can credit to it. All right? Sometimes they're pretty severe. I had a friend, he was a hunter. And he'd been hunting a long time. And so I don't know why he did this, but he had a black powder rifle. And he decided that he'd put some smokeless powder inside of it to see if it'd shoot a little faster, get a little more speed out of the bullet. The problem is you don't really want to do that. Black powder burns at a different rate, and he it was a muzzle loader. He filled it with some smokeless powder, and when he fired the gun didn't fire, it exploded, and it blew off three of his fingers. And there was the piece of it, thankfully, went the other direction than him, because it was almost lined up with his head, but it went through the side of his hunting trailer. Now, when you talk to him about it later, he said, that was the dumbest thing. I don't know why I did that. I should have known better. I've been hunting my whole life. I should have known better than that. Okay? So in that case, he's not saying, God, why am I suffering? I've been righteous. He's saying, I was dumb. Right? We've sort of been there in times. You back your car into something and you think, I know better to look when I go backwards, right? So I hit the post because I didn't look. We don't say, God, why would this happen to me? We go, that was foolish of me. And there's been a few times you go, whew, I got, you know, that one almost ended really badly. That's not the situation we're talking about. The situation we're talking about is, you brought your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and one of them doesn't want to follow Christ. You worked hard at your marriage, and your spouse doesn't want to stay together. You worked hard at work and did a good job, and yet you're the one who got fired when they had to make cuts. We're all going to find ourselves in those places. We're going to say, I was righteous. Why did this happen to me? This isn't fair. All right? We love to say that. The children are really good at it, but we say it as adults too, right? Children don't get what they want. They say, that's not fair. Somehow they never ask for fair when they do wrong. Neither do we, right? So, you know, say, well, you disobeyed, so there's going to be a consequence, they say. And then you say, but I'm going to be merciful this time and give you a warning. They don't go, that's not fair. I have to get the consequence. Right? They don't do that. But when they don't get something they feel they've earned, they say, that's not fair. And we do the same thing. We're just more sophisticated about it as adults. Or at least we think we are. And we find ourselves in the same place as Job. God, how could I be here? And so I want us to understand this. We need to marinate in this passage for a moment and just go, I'm going to get here. There's going to be a time in my life when I face this, and I need this message of the book of Job. That, as I said last week, there are going to be times in our life as Christians when we face hardships and we're going to say, God, why? But like the psalmist, as we read through the psalms, they're going to be saying, well, how long, O Lord, or why, Lord? But when they come to the end of the psalm, they always end in praise. And we have to come back to who God is. All right? I know Job's righteous from this passage, and I know God's just. I don't question God's justice. Now, there are times in life I might be led to, but my conclusion always has to come back to God is just. But yet the retributive principle does seem to operate in life at times. People who live wicked lives do seem to get bad things, and people who generally fulfill their obligations and go to work and do the things that are righteous, they generally, good things happen. All right? You go to work every day, you work hard, save up a little money, you usually can do okay in life. Keep your obligations, be faithful to your family and your spouse, and things usually turn out. So we look at the retributive principle, and we see it at work, in life. But you see the tension, and that's what the book wants us to feel right here, is this tension. So I want us to understand that it's not wrong for us to feel this tension. The book's not written so that we would ignore this tension. It's written for us to wrestle with it, for us to understand that even when we hit difficulties in life, there are going to be times that we don't clearly see God's justice. But God's answer later in the book is, trust me. Okay? Think about this as children. There were things that, you know, you didn't want done. Remember one of my sons, when he would get a splinter, the last thing he wanted you to do was pull it out. Okay? I mean, you'd think you were killing him when you're pulling a splinter out. You know, there were times, literally, you'd have to, like, pin him down because he'd be pulling his hand away, and so you'd have to grab his hand and get the tweezers and, son, this is going to get infected if we leave it in. Trust me, it's a lot better to just pull it out right now than it is to leave it. And as an adult, we look at that and we go, of course, that makes sense. But as a child, you're just like, no, you can't do this to me. And sometimes our answer, I mean, you can tell a child about an infection, but they've never had an infection. That means nothing. It's going to get infected. Oh, I don't care. Just don't pull it out. Right? They're not going to care. It just hurts for you to pull it out, so don't dig it out. But yet as a parent, we knew better. And at a certain point, we just said, we're going to do this, and you have to trust that mommy and daddy have your best interest in mind here. And I'm not getting to the full conclusion, but I don't want to leave it at such a low note where chapter 3 is, and that is that God's ultimate answer is trust him. Trust him. That we can go to the Lord and trust him. There will be times when we don't see how things are just or fair or why things happen to us and we don't understand them. We are going to be exactly where Job is. Maybe not as severely, but we're going to find ourselves in the same spiritual quandary. And God didn't leave us without an answer. He gave us a whole book of 40 plus chapters to give us an answer to this. We're all going to be Job. We're all going to suffer. So I don't want us to feel, you know, I think our quote on the wall was appropriate. There is a version of Christianity around that is shallow, trite, superficial, happy-clappy. It is the kind of Christianity that, as has been said, would have had Jesus singing a chorus at the grave of Lazarus. We have all met it, easy triumphalism. In other words, it's the kind of thing that is kind of superficial, and when small difficulties come into life, we say, well, oh well. I had a sermon like that years ago. Guy told a story about all these things that went wrong, and every time they'd say, oh well. Oh well isn't a biblical response. The Bible never tells us to say, oh well. And the things he gave, yes, they were difficulties. They were cars breaking down, and they were difficulties, but they weren't what Job faced. And nobody's going to lose their spouse who they've been married to for 50 years and say, oh well. And nobody's going to lose a child prematurely and say, oh well. And no one is going to lose their job unfairly and say, oh well. And no one is going to be diagnosed with cancer or heart disease and say, oh well. See, that answer falls short. That's what we mean by a happy, clappy Christianity, that at small trials can say, oh well, and see, this is what it means to be a Christian. It's always happy. And the fact is, it's not always happy, but God is always there. It's not always happy, but God is always there. And he's saying, trust me. And that's where the book of Job is going. So I hope this is a help to you. I know all of us, some of you are in the midst of a trial. Some of you have recently gone through trials. And those who haven't, you're headed for a trial. So we deeply need to learn. I don't say that to be miserable. I say that because God didn't give us this book by accident. He wants us to learn the lessons of Job. Let's bow our heads.